This is disc number 3.
Signals that tend to arrive at separate times, like thumbs and pinkies, have more distant brain maps because neurons that fire apart wire apart. Many, if not all, brain maps work by spatially grouping together events that happen together. As we have seen, the auditory map is arranged like a piano, with mapping regions for low notes at one end and for high notes at the other. Why is it so orderly? Because the low frequencies of sounds tend to come together with one another in nature. When we hear a person with a low voice, most of the frequencies are low, so they get grouped together. The arrival of Bill Jenkins at Mrzenik's lab ushered in a new phase of research that would help Mrzenik develop practical applications of his discoveries. Jenkins, trained as a behavioral psychologist, was especially interested in understanding how we learn. He suggested they teach animals to learn new skills to observe how learning affected their neurons and maps. In one basic experiment, they mapped a monkey's sensory cortex. Then they trained it to touch a spinning disc with its fingertip, with just the right amount of pressure for 10 seconds to get a banana pellet reward. This required the monkey to pay close attention, learning to touch the disc very lightly and judge time accurately. After thousands of trials, Mrzenik and Jenkins remapped the monkey's brain and saw that the area mapping the monkey's fingertip had enlarged as the monkey had learned how to touch the disc with the right amount of pressure. The experiment showed that when an animal is motivated to learn, the brain responds plastically. The experiment also showed that as brain maps get bigger, the individual neurons get more efficient in two stages. At first, as the monkey trained, the map for the fingertip grew to take up more space. But after a while, individual neurons within the map became more efficient, and eventually fewer neurons were required to perform the task. When a child learns to play piano scales for the first time, he tends to use his whole upper body, wrist, arm, shoulder, to play each note. Even the facial muscles tighten into a grimace. With practice, the budding pianist stops using irrelevant muscles and soon uses only the correct finger to play the note. He develops a lighter touch, and if he becomes skillful, he develops grace and relaxes when he plays. This is because the child goes from using a massive number of neurons to an appropriate few, well matched to the task. This more efficient use of neurons occurs whenever we become proficient at a skill, and it explains why we don't quickly run out of map space as we practice or add skills to our repertoire. Mrzenik and Jenkins also showed that individual neurons got more selective with training. Each neuron in a brain map for the sense of touch has a receptive field, a segment on the skin surface that reports to it. As the monkeys were trained to feel the disc, the receptive fields of individual neurons got smaller, firing only when small parts of the fingertip touched the disc. Thus, despite the fact that the size of the brain map increased, each neuron in the map became responsible for a smaller part of the skin surface, allowing the animal to have finer touch discrimination. Overall, the map became more precise. Mrzenik and Jenkins also found that as neurons are trained and become more efficient, they can process faster. This means that the speed at which we think is itself plastic. Speed of thought is essential to our survival. Events often happen quickly, and if the brain is slow, it can miss important information. In one experiment, Mrzenik and Jenkins successfully trained monkeys to distinguish sounds in shorter and shorter spans of time. The trained neurons fired more quickly in response to the sounds, processed them in a shorter time, and needed less time to rest between firings. Faster neurons ultimately lead to faster thoughts, no minor matter. Because speed of thought is a crucial component of intelligence. IQ tests, like life, measure not only whether you can get the right answer, but how long it takes you to get it. They also discovered that as they trained an animal at a skill, not only did its neurons fire faster, but because they were faster, their signals were clearer. Faster neurons were more likely to fire in sync with each other, becoming better team players, wiring together more and forming groups of neurons that gave off clearer and more powerful signals. This is a crucial point, because a powerful signal has greater impact on the brain. When we want to remember something we have heard, we must hear it clearly. because a memory can be only as clear as its original signal. Finally, Merzenich discovered that paying close attention is essential to long-term plastic change. In numerous experiments, he found that lasting changes occurred only when his monkeys paid close attention. When the animals performed tasks automatically without paying attention, they changed their brain maps, but the changes did not last. We often praise the ability to multitask. While you can learn when you divide your attention, divided attention doesn't lead to abiding change in your brain maps. When Merzenich was a boy, his mother's first cousin, a grade school teacher in Wisconsin, was chosen Teacher of the Year for the entire United States. After the ceremony at the White House, she visited the Merzenich family in Oregon. "My mother," he recalls, "asked the inane question that you'd ask in conversation, 'What are your most important principles in teaching?' And her cousin answered, 'Well, you test them when they come into school and you figure out whether they are worthwhile. And if they are worthwhile, you really pay attention to them, and you don't waste time on the ones that aren't.'" That's what she said. And you know, in one way or another, that's reflected in how people have treated children who are different forever. It's just so destructive to imagine that your neurological resources are permanent and enduring and cannot be substantially improved and altered. Merzenich now became aware of the work of Paula Talal at Rutgers, who had begun to analyze why children have trouble learning to read. Somewhere between 5% and 10% of preschool children have a language disability that makes it difficult for them to read, write, or even follow instructions. Sometimes these children are called dyslexic. Babies begin talking by practicing consonant-vowel combinations, cooing da-da-da and ba-ba-ba. In many languages, their first words consist of such combinations. In English, their first words are often mama and dada, pee-pee, and so on. Talal's research showed that children with language disabilities have auditory processing problems with common consonant-vowel combinations that are spoken quickly and are called the fast parts of speech. The children have trouble hearing them accurately and, as a result, reproducing them accurately. Merzenich believed that these children's auditory cortex neurons were firing too slowly, so they couldn't distinguish between two very similar sounds or be certain if two sounds occurred close together, which was first and which was second. Often they didn't hear the beginnings of syllables or the sound changes within syllables. Normally, neurons, after they have processed a sound, are ready to fire again after about a 30-millisecond rest. 80% of language-impaired children took at least 3 times that long, so that they lost large amounts of language information. When their neuron firing patterns were examined, the signals weren't clear. They were muddy in, muddy out, says Merzenich. Improper hearing led to weaknesses in all the language tasks, so they were weak in vocabulary, comprehension, speech, reading, and writing. Because they spent so much energy decoding words, they tended to use shorter sentences and failed to exercise their memory for longer sentences. The language processing was more childlike or delayed, and they still needed practice distinguishing da-da-da and ba-ba-ba. When Talal originally discovered their problem, she feared that these kids were broken and there was nothing you could do to fix their basic brain defect. But that was before she and Merzenich combined forces. In 1996, Merzenich, Paula Talal, Bill Jenkins, and one of Talal's colleagues, psychologist Steve Miller, formed the nucleus of a company, Scientific Learning, that is wholly devoted to using neuroplastic research to help people rewire their brains. Their head office is in the Rotunda, a Beaux-Arts masterpiece with an elliptical glass dome 120 feet high, its edges painted in 24-karat gold leaf in the middle of downtown Oakland, California. When you enter another world. The Scientific Learning staff includes child psychologists, plasticity researchers, experts in human motivation, speech pathologists, engineers, programmers, and animators. From their desks, these researchers, bathed in natural light, can look up into the gorgeous dome. Fast Forward is the name of the training program they developed for language-impaired and learning-disabled children. The program exercises every basic brain function involved in language, from decoding sounds up to comprehension, a kind of cerebral cross-training. The program offers 7 brain exercises. One teaches the children to improve their ability to distinguish short sounds from long. A cow flies across the computer screen, making a series of mooing sounds. The child has to catch the cow with a computer cursor and hold it by depressing the mouse button. Then suddenly, the length of the moo sound changes subtly. At this point, the child must release the cow and let it fly away. A child who releases it just after the sound changes scores points. In another game, children learn to identify easily confused consonant-vowel combinations such as ba and da, first at slower speeds than they occur in normal language, and then at increasingly faster speeds. Another game teaches the children to hear faster and faster frequency glides, sounds like whoop that sweep up. Another teaches them to remember and match sounds. The fast parts of speech are used throughout the exercises, but have been slowed down with the help of computers, so the language-disabled children can hear them and develop clear maps for them. Then gradually, over the course of the exercises, they are sped up. Whenever a goal is achieved, something funny happens. The character in the animation eats the answer, gets indigestion, gets a funny look on its face, or makes some slapstick move that is unexpected enough to keep the child attentive. This reward is a crucial feature of the program, because each time the child is rewarded, his brain secretes such neurotransmitters as dopamine and acetylcholine, which help consolidate the map changes he has just made. Dopamine reinforces the reward, and acetylcholine helps the brain tune in and sharpen memories. Children with milder difficulties typically work at fast forward for 1 hour and 40 minutes a day, 5 days a week for several weeks, and those with more severe difficulties work for 8 to 12 weeks. The first study results reported in the journal Science in January 1996 were remarkable. Children with language impairments were divided into 2 groups, one that did fast forward and a control group that did a computer game that was similar but didn't train temporal processing or used modified speech. The 2 groups were matched for age, IQ, and language processing skills. The children who did fast forward made significant progress on standard speech, language, and auditory processing tests, ended up with normal or better than normal language scores, and kept their gains when retested 6 weeks after training. They improved far more than children in the control group. Further study followed 500 children at 35 sites, hospitals, homes, and clinics. All were given standardized language tests before and after fast-forward training. The study showed that most children's ability to understand language normalized after fast-forward. In many cases, their comprehension rose above normal. The average child who took the program moved ahead 1.8 years of language development in 6 weeks, remarkably fast progress. A Stanford group did brain scans of 20 dyslexic children before and after fast forward. The opening scan showed that the children used different parts of their brains for reading than normal children do. After fast forward, new scans showed that their brains had begun to normalize. For instance, they developed increased activity, on average, in the left temporoparietal cortex, and their scans began to show patterns that were similar to those of children who have no reading problems. Willie Arbor is a 7-year-old from West Virginia. He's got red hair and freckles, belongs to Cub Scouts, likes going to the mall, and, though barely over 4 feet tall, loves wrestling. He's just gone through fast forward and has been transformed. Willie's main problem was hearing the speech of others clearly, his mother explains. I might say the word copy, and he would think I said coffee. If there was any background noise, it was especially hard for him to hear. Kindergarten was depressing. You could see his insecurity. He got into nervous habits like chewing on his clothes or his sleeve because everyone else was getting the answer right and he wasn't. The teacher had actually talked about holding him back in first grade. Willie had trouble reading, both to himself and aloud. Willie, his mother continues, couldn't hear changes in pitch properly, so he couldn't tell when a person was making an exclamation or just a general statement, and he didn't grasp inflections in speech, which made it hard for him to read people's emotions. Without the high and low pitch, he wasn't hearing that wow when people are excited. It was like everything was the same. Willie was taken to a hearing specialist who diagnosed his hearing problem as caused by an auditory processing disorder that originated in his brain. He had difficulty remembering strings of words because his auditory system was so easily overloaded. If you gave him more than three instructions, such as, "Please put your shoes upstairs, put them in the closet, then come down for dinner," he'd forget them. He'd take his shoes off, go up the steps, and ask, "Mom, what did you want me to do?" Teachers had to repeat instructions all the time. Though he appeared to be a gifted child, he was good at math. His problems held him back in that area, too. His mother protested, making Willie repeat first grade, and over the summer sent him to Fast Forward for 8 weeks. Before he did Fast Forward, his mother recalls, "You'd put him at the computer and he got very stressed out. With this program, though, he spent 100 minutes a day for a solid 8 weeks at the computer. He loved doing it and loved the scoring system because he could see himself going up, up, up," says his mother. As he improved, he became able to perceive inflections in speech, got better at reading the emotions of others, and became a less anxious child. So much changed for him. When he brought his midterms home, he said, "It's better than last year, Mommy." He began bringing home A and B marks on his papers most of the time, a noticeable difference. Now it's, "I can do this. This is my grade. I can make it better." I feel like I had my prayer answered. It's done so much for him. It's amazing. A year later, he continues to improve. Merzenich's team started hearing that Fast Forward was having a number of spillover effects. Children's handwriting improved. Parents reported that many of the students were starting to show sustained attention and focus. Merzenich thought these surprising benefits were occurring because Fast Forward led to some general improvements in mental processing. One of the most important brain activities, one we don't often think about, is the determination of how long things go on, or temporal processing. You can't move properly, perceive properly, or predict properly if you can't determine how long events last. Merzenich discovered that when you train people to distinguish very fast vibrations on their skin, lasting only 75 milliseconds, these same people could detect 75 millisecond sounds as well. It seemed that Fast Forward was improving the brain's general ability to keep time. Sometimes these improvements spilled over into visual processing as well. Before Fast Forward, when Willie was given a game that asked which items are out of place, a boot up in the tree or a tin can on the roof, his eyes jumped all over the page. He was trying to see the whole page instead of taking in a little section at a time. At school, he skipped lines when he read. After Fast Forward, his eyes no longer jumped around the page and he was able to focus his visual attention. A number of children who took standardized tests shortly after completing Fast Forward showed improvements not only in language, speaking, and reading, but in math, science, and social studies as well. Perhaps these children were hearing what was going on in class better or were better able to read, but Merzenich thought it might be more complicated. "You know," he says, "IQ goes up. We use the matrix test, which is a visual-based measurement of IQ, and IQ goes up." The fact that a visual component of the IQ went up meant that the IQ improvements were not caused simply because Fast Forward improved the children's ability to read verbal test questions. Their mental processing was being improved in a general way, possibly because their temporal processing was improving. And there were other unexpected benefits. Some children with autism began to make some general progress. The mystery of autism, a human mind that cannot conceive of other minds, is one of the most baffling and poignant in psychiatry and one of the most severe developmental disorders of childhood. It is called a pervasive development disorder because so many aspects of development are disturbed: intelligence, perception, socializing skills, language, and emotion. Most autistic children have an IQ of less than 70. They have major problems connecting socially to others and may, in severe cases, treat people like inanimate objects, neither greeting them nor acknowledging them as human beings. At times it seems that autistics don't have a sense that other minds exist in the world. They also have perceptual processing difficulties and are thus often hypersensitive to sound and touch, easily overloaded by stimulation. That may be one reason autistic children often avoid eye contact. The stimulation from people, especially when coming from many senses at once, is too intense. Their neural networks appear to be overactive, and many of these children have epilepsy. Because so many autistic children have language impairments, clinicians began to suggest the fast-forward program for them. They never anticipated what might happen. Parents of autistic children who did fast-forward told Merzenich that their children became more connected socially. He began asking, were the children simply being trained to be more attentive listeners? And he was fascinated by the fact that with fast-forward, both the language symptoms and the autistic symptoms seemed to be fading together. Could this mean that the language and autistic problems were different expressions of a common problem? Two studies of autistic children confirmed what Merzenich had been hearing. One, a language study, showed that fast-forward quickly moved autistic children from severe language impairment to the normal range. But another pilot study of 100 autistic children showed that fast-forward had a significant impact on their autistic symptoms as well. Their attention spans improved. Their sense of humor improved. They became more connected to people. They developed better eye contact, began greeting people and addressing them by name, spoke with them, and said goodbye at the end of their encounters. It seemed the children were beginning to experience the world as filled with other human minds. Laura Lee, an 8-year-old autistic girl, was diagnosed with moderate autism when she was 3. Even as an 8-year-old, she rarely used language. She didn't answer to her name, and to her parents, it seemed she was not hearing it. Sometimes she would speak, but when she did, she had her own language, says her mother, which was often unintelligible. If she wanted juice, she didn't ask for it. She would make gestures and pull her parents over to the cabinets to get things for her. She had other autistic symptoms, among them the repetitive movements that autistic children use to try to contain their sense of being overwhelmed. According to her mother, Laura Lee had the whole works, the flapping of the hands, toe walking, a lot of energy, biting, and she couldn't tell me what she was feeling. She was very attached to trees. When her parents took her walking in the evening to burn off energy, she'd often stop, touch a tree, hug it, and speak to it. Laura Lee was unusually sensitive to sounds. She had bionic ears, says her mother. When she was little, she would often cover her ears. She couldn't tolerate certain music on the radio, like classical and slow music. At her pediatrician's office, she heard sounds from the floor upstairs that others didn't. At home, she would go over to the sinks, fill them with water, then wrap herself around the pipes, hugging them, listening to the water drain through them. Laura Lee's father is in the Navy and served in the Iraq War in 2003. When the family was transferred to California, Laura Lee was enrolled in a public school with a special ed class that used Fast Forward. The program took her about 2 hours a day for 8 weeks to complete. When she finished it, she had an explosion in language, says her mother, and began to speak more and use complete sentences. She could tell me about her days at school. Before, I would just say, did you have a good day or a bad day? Now she was able to say what she did, and she remembered details. If she got into a bad situation, she would be able to tell me, and I wouldn't have to prompt her to get it out of her. She also found it easier to remember things. Laura Lee has always loved to read, but now she is reading longer books, nonfiction, and the encyclopedia. She is listening to quieter sounds now and can tolerate different sounds from the radio, says her mother. It was an awakening for her. And with a better communication, there was an awakening for all of us. It was a big blessing. Merzenich decided that to deepen his understanding of autism and its many developmental delays, he would have to go back to the lab. He thought the best way to go about it was to first produce an autistic animal, one that had multiple developmental delays, as autistic children do. Then he could study it and try to treat it. As Merzenich began to think through what he calls the infantile catastrophe of autism, he had a hunch that something might be going wrong in infancy. When most critical periods occur, plasticity is at its height, and a massive amount of development should be occurring. But autism is largely an inherited condition. If one identical twin is autistic, there is an 80 to 90% chance the other twin will be as well. In cases of non-identical twins, where one is autistic, the non-autistic twin will often have some language and social problems. Yet the incidence of autism has been climbing at a staggering rate that can't be explained by genetics alone. When the condition was first recognized over 40 years ago, about 1 in 5,000 people had it. Now, Merzenich believes, it is at least 15 in 5,000. That number has risen partly because autism is more often diagnosed and because some children are labeled mildly autistic to get public funding for treatment. But, says Merzenich, even when all of the corrections are made by very hard-assed epidemiologists, it looks like it's about a threefold increase over the last 15 years. There is a world emergency that relates to risk factors for autism. He has come to think it likely that an environmental factor affects the neural circuits in these children, forcing the critical periods to shut down early, before the brain maps are fully differentiated. When we are born, our brain maps are often rough drafts or sketches, lacking detail, undifferentiated. In the critical period, when the structure of our brain maps is literally getting shaped by our first worldly experiences, the rough draft normally becomes detailed and differentiated. Merzenich and his team used micro-mapping to show how maps in newborn rats are formed in the critical period. Right after birth, at the beginning of the critical period, auditory maps were undifferentiated, with only two broad regions in the cortex. Half of the map responded to any high-frequency sound. The other half responded to any low-frequency sound. When the animal was exposed to a particular frequency during the critical period, that simple organization changed. If the animal was repeatedly exposed to a high C, after a while only a few neurons would turn on, becoming selective for high C. The same would happen when the animal was exposed to a D, E, F, and so on. Now the map, instead of having two broad areas, had many different areas, each responding to different notes. It was now differentiated. What is remarkable about the cortex in the critical period is that it is so plastic that its structure can be changed just by exposing it to new stimuli. That sensitivity allows babies and very young children in the critical period of language development to pick up new sounds and words effortlessly, simply by hearing their parents speak. Mere exposure causes their brain maps to wire in the changes. After the critical period, older children and adults can, of course, learn languages, but they really have to work to pay attention. For Merzenich, the difference between critical period plasticity and adult plasticity is that in the critical period, the brain maps can be changed just by being exposed to the world because the learning machinery is continuously on. It makes good biological sense for this machinery always to be on because babies can't possibly know what will be important in life. So they pay attention to everything. Only a brain that is already somewhat organized can sort out what is worth paying attention to. The next clue Merzenich needed in order to understand autism came from a line of research that was originated during the Second World War in fascist Italy by a young Jewish woman, Rita Levi Montalcini, while in hiding. Levi Montalcini was born in Turin in 1909 and attended medical school there. In 1938, when Mussolini barred Jews from practicing medicine and doing scientific research, she fled to Brussels to continue her studies. When the Nazis threatened Belgium, she went back to Turin and built a secret laboratory in her bedroom to study how nerves form, forging microsurgical equipment from sewing needles. When the Allies bombed Turin in 1940, she fled to Piedmont. One day in 1940, traveling to a small northern Italian village in a cattle car that had been converted into a passenger train, she sat down on the floor and read a scientific paper by Victor Hamburger, who had been doing pioneering work on the development of neurons by studying chick embryos. She decided to repeat and extend his experiments, working on a table in a mountain house with eggs from a local farmer. When she finished each experiment, she ate the eggs. After the war, Humberger invited Levi Montalcini to join him and his researchers in St. Louis to work on their discovery that the nerve fibers of chicks grew faster in the presence of tumors from mice. Levi Montalcini speculated that the tumor might be releasing a substance to promote nerve growth. With biochemist Stanley Cohen, she isolated the protein responsible and called it nerve growth factor, or NGF. Levi Montalcini and Cohen were awarded the Nobel Prize in 1986. Levi Montalcini's work led to the discovery of a number of such nerve growth factors, one of which, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF, caught Mrzenek's attention. BDNF plays a crucial role in reinforcing plastic changes made in the brain in the critical period. According to Mrzenek, it does this in four different ways. When we perform an activity that requires specific neurons to fire together, they release BDNF. This growth factor consolidates the connections between those neurons and helps to wire them together so they fire together reliably in the future. BDNF also promotes the growth of the thin fatty coat around every neuron that speeds up the transmission of electrical signals. During the critical period, BDNF turns on the nucleus basalis, the part of our brain that allows us to focus our attention, and keeps it on throughout the entire critical period. Once turned on, the nucleus basalis helps us not only pay attention but remember what we are experiencing. It allows map differentiation and change to take place effortlessly. Mrzenek told me, "It is like a teacher in the brain saying, 'Now this is really important. This you have to know for the exam of life.'" Mrzenek calls the nucleus basalis and the attention system the modulatory control system of plasticity, the neurochemical system that, when turned on, puts the brain in an extremely plastic state. The fourth and final service that BDNF performs, when it has completed strengthening key connections, is to help close down the critical period. Once the main neuronal connections are laid down, there is a need for stability and hence less plasticity in the system. When BDNF is released in sufficient quantities, it turns off the nucleus basalis and ends that magical epoch of effortless learning. Henceforth, the nucleus can be activated only when something important, surprising, or novel occurs, or if we make the effort to pay close attention. Mrzenek's work on the critical period and BDNF helped him develop a theory that explains how so many different problems could be part of a single autistic whole. During the critical period, he argues, some situations overexcite the neurons in children who have genes that predispose them to autism, leading to the massive premature release of BDNF. Instead of important connections being reinforced, all connections are. So much BDNF is released that it turns off the critical period prematurely, sealing all these connections in place, and the child is left with scores of undifferentiated brain maps and hence pervasive developmental disorders. Their brains are hyper-excitable and hypersensitive. If they hear one frequency, the whole auditory cortex starts firing. This is what seemed to be happening in Laura Lee, who had to cover her bionic ears when she heard music. Other autistic children are hypersensitive to touch and feel tormented when the labels in their clothes touch their skin. Mrzenek's theory also explains the high rates of epilepsy in autism. Because of BDNF release, the brain maps are poorly differentiated, and because so many connections in the brain have been indiscriminately reinforced, once a few neurons start firing, the whole brain can be set off. It also explains why autistic children have bigger brains. The substance increases the fatty coating around the neurons. If BDNF release was contributing to autism and language problems, Mrzenek needed to understand what might cause young neurons to get overexcited and release massive amounts of the chemical. Several studies alerted him to how an environmental factor might contribute. One disturbing study showed that the closer children lived to the noisy airport in Frankfurt, Germany, the lower their intelligence was. A similar study on children in public housing high-rises above the Dan Ryan Expressway in Chicago found that the closer their floor was to the highway, the lower their intelligence. So Mrzenek began wondering about the role of a new environmental risk factor that might affect everyone, but have a more damaging effect on genetically predisposed children. The continuous background noise from machines, sometimes called white noise. White noise consists of many frequencies and is very stimulating to the auditory cortex. Infants are reared in continuously more noisy environments. There is always a din, he says. White noise is everywhere now, coming from fans in our electronics, air conditioners, heaters, and car engines. How would such noise affect the developing brain? Mrzenek wondered. To test this hypothesis, his group exposed rat pups to pulses of white noise throughout their critical period and found that the pups' cortices were devastated. Every time you have a pulse, Mrzenek says, you are exciting everything in the auditory cortex, every neuron. So many neurons firing results in a massive BDNF release. And as his model predicted, this exposure brings the critical period to a premature close. The animals are left with undifferentiated brain maps and utterly indiscriminate neurons that get turned on by any frequency. Mrzenek found that these rat pups, like autistic children, were predisposed to epilepsy, and exposing them to normal speech caused them to have epileptic fits. Human epileptics find that strobe lights at rock concerts set off their seizures. Strobes are pulsed emissions of white light and consist of many frequencies as well. Mrzenek now had his animal model for autism. Recent brain scan studies now confirmed that autistic children do indeed process sound in an abnormal way. Mrzenek thinks that the undifferentiated cortex helps to explain why they have trouble learning, because a child with an undifferentiated cortex has a very difficult time paying attention. When asked to focus on one thing, these children experience booming, buzzing confusion, one reason autistic children often withdraw from the world and develop a shell. Mrzenek thinks this same problem, in a milder form, may contribute to more common attention disorders. Now the question for Mrzenek was, could anything be done to normalize undifferentiated brain maps after the critical period? If he and his team could do so, they could offer hope for autistic children. Using white noise, they first de-differentiated the auditory maps of rats. Then, after the damage was done, they normalized and re-differentiated the maps using very simple tones, one at a time. With training, in fact, they brought the maps to an above-normal range. And that, says Mrzenek, is exactly what we are trying to do in these autistic children. He is currently developing a modification of Fast Forward that is designed for autism, a refinement of the program that helped Laura Lee.